Welcome to the Ackerman Center podcast.
As a digital extension of the Ackerman Center, our goal is to teach the past so we can change the future.
In doing so, we address issues related to Holocaust, genocide, and human rights studies from diverse perspectives.
Thank you all for being here again. It's always good fun to meet up again for yet another podcast. Today we're here with our very special guest, Glenn Kurtz, who's joining us to talk about his wonderful book, 3 Minutes in Poland, Discovering a Lost World, in a 1938 family film, and then to talk also about the adaptation, the transformation of that original footage into a full-length movie that, however, has a slightly different title, 3 Minutes Lengthening. But first, before we get into it, do you mind telling us a little bit about how you got to this point of writing this book and eventually also being involved in making of a movie?
Sure. Well, first, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. You know, I don't have a background as a Holocaust scholar. I was, first of all, a musician, and then, I guess by some stretch of the imagination, a literary scholar. In any case, I did my PhD. But I came to this more or less by chance, which is really the dominant force in so much of this story. I was writing a novel, actually. And in 2008, I happened to see a presentation about, this was at the anniversary of the Anschluss, the German annexation of Austria in 1938. And 2008 was a round anniversary, and I went to a program about an orphan film that had been found in the flea market, which showed mostly just family scenes. But then at the very end, there were 6 seconds which showed these Reibparteien, the so-called Reib, these are Jews being forced to clean the streets. And I thought, well, this makes the novel that I'm working on makes complete sense, and I stole that as my plot. So it was a film about someone who finds an old movie in a flea market and then becomes obsessed with identifying the people, the anonymous people who appear in it. In the course of researching that, I had to learn a great deal about how old film deteriorates, and in the course of that research, I remembered that my family had some old family movies, and I wondered what had become of them. So I went to search for them, and then in 2009 I found this film from 1938 that my grandfather had taken on a trip that he and my grandmother and some friends took to Europe. And in the middle of this 14-minute long film, there are 3 minutes in Poland. And that became the title of my book. I then lived the plot of the novel that I had been writing, and I became obsessed with trying to identify the individuals who appear in this footage. And well, now that's 14 years ago, and I'm still at it.
Very interesting. But, you know, just to come back to this, there's something that for us already at the outset is almost difficult to fathom, and that is that there's a circle of friends with immigrant background, Eastern European Jews who live in the United States, embark on their grand tour in the beginning of 1938 to see all the famous sites. And then as they're passing through all these great historical sites, they also, quote unquote, go home. But in other words, all of this presupposes still a sense of normality of sorts, right? Which is not the first thing that comes to our mind often when we think about 1938. So this kind of sense of time that would have shaped their respective plans and execution of this trip is very different from the time that we now, looking back, ascribe to that moment. How did you deal with that?
Of course, one wants one's grandparents to have been prophets, and to have known what was going to happen. But their 1938 was not our 1938. And, you know, we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow or this afternoon. We don't know what world events that are worrisome today are going to be catastrophic tomorrow. And they, I think, as well, they believed what they read in the papers, which was that, you know, Neville Chamberlain was going to bring peace in our time. Mm-hmm. This is already before the Sudeten crisis was sort of brewing as they left for Europe. That was in July of 1938 that they left. They came back on Labor Day, September 5th. And on the ship was the British ambassador to Spain. And he's interviewed as the ship arrives in New York in September 1938. And he says, yes, of course, the current difficulties will be resolved peacefully. So I think that they, to them, it was normality. Yes, the world is a fraught place and there's all sorts of things happening. The more specific problem, of course, is the treatment of Jews in Germany. They did not visit Germany, but they passed through Germany. You can't get to Poland from Belgium without passing through Germany. And they changed trains in Berlin in August of 1938. And my grandfather sent a postcard to his daughter, who was 15 years old, just saying, oh, here we are having a nice glass of beer in Berlin. It's not what you would hope to hear from them. Nevertheless, well, who knows if he's writing to his 15-year-old daughter, whether he's going to express his concerns about the fate of Europe. But, you know, I think that they were not uninformed people, but Europe was distant, and Chamberlain himself, when announcing the Munich Agreement, is going to say, you know, why should we care about people in a country about which we know so little, which is so far away? I think that they felt protected by an ocean, like so many Americans did. And there were tens of thousands of other American tourists in Europe that summer, and Germany was a big draw. Lots of people took their, you know, their Rhine River cruises. So while I wish that they had been other than ordinary Americans. They were ordinary Americans and had, I think, the common attitudes of the time.
I'm sitting here with two of our very talented PhD students, Katie and Angie, but before they're going to ask you a couple of questions, let me just get your biography right, because I want to, like, really, you know, think about what it takes to write a novel. So you are a classical guitar player who gets a PhD in German literature studies and comparative literature, who then, however, ends up writing his first book on music, then to become the historians of discovering a lost world in 1938. So in other words, there's a lot of, like, curious intersections, but not, you know, the way in which you come to this book is not, you know, really just through the lens of a historian. You're the grandson, you are a writer, you're a historian, you're a musician. Does that have any bearing on how you ultimately were to come to how to deal with this inheritance of this movie?
Well, that's a really interesting and a deep question, personally deep question, and I'll answer it in this way. My first life was as you say, a classical guitarist. And that was, I began that very early in life, 6 or 7 years old, I started playing the guitar. And I had formulated these artistic dreams for myself that I was going to become a concert performing guitarist in the mold of Andres Segovia. And, well, there's a couple of people in the world who succeed at that particular dream, but not very many. You can count them on, you know, on the fingers of one hand. And at some point, I realized that that dream was likely not going to come true for me. And that was a terrible, terrible disappointment. It was probably the greatest loss I had experienced up to that time in my mid-20s. And I liken it to sort of a breakup of a deep love. It was, in fact, my first love, and it broke my heart. And if I look back then, so my first book, Practicing, A Musician's Return to Music, is 10 years later coming back and looking at that relationship and wondering why it ended so catastrophically for me. So fast forward a couple of years and I end up writing 3 Minutes in Poland about a lost family film and the lost community that it documents. And I think, well, these are remarkably different books. What is the thing that connects them? And I realize what the thing that connects them is this sensitivity to what remains when something is lost. Mm-hmm. I felt that my musical career and all that time and love and effort that I had put into it was lost, and I wrote that book in a sense to try to make meaning out of that loss. And the book was the result of that process. And in the same way, I inherited this film shortly before my father died. It was his father who took it, and I think I was consumed at that time by that very question, what remains when someone dies? And then here's an artifact which is something that remains after an entire community, indeed an entire culture, has been destroyed. And so I felt deeply, deeply motivated by that same sort of I don't know what to call it exactly, just a deeply emotional response to this sense of loss. Is there a possibility of making meaning out of what feels so, you know, irretrievably lost?
It's a great lead into my question, actually. In watching the film and also hearing the story, what I was struck by is the absences in the film and also in this wondering, you know, who are these people that are shown, and in the city itself, the absence of memorials to Jewish life. I was struck by how that parallels the medium itself of film and the deterioration of the film. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about you wrestling with the absences in the film deteriorating and also this obsessive longing to know who the people were in the film.
Yeah. Well, as I say, I began the research under the sign of loss. and I, of course, never imagined I would write a Holocaust or Holocaust era story. I read a great deal in my research and in my preparation. And I became very dissatisfied with a great deal of the, you know, parallel kinds of books to my own. I didn't think of myself as a historian. I wasn't trying to write a history of this town or a history of the Holocaust in this region. I was trying to write very, very narrowly this micro history of this film, just asking, what do we see in the film? What is this evidence of? Which is itself an almost impossible question to answer. And it's an impossible question to answer because of what happened. So I became extremely, almost militantly averse to a certain kind of Holocaust historiography which tries to make up the losses, either by having some kind of happy ending. Oh, this person survived, and so that somehow makes everything, you know, better. We can feel better about ourselves because our hero survives. Or, in a sense, worse still, the, you know, something that you see so commonly, especially about films and images, is, well, we know nothing at all about the people that we're looking at, but they look just like us. Therefore, they were just like us, and we somehow know them, therefore. And I was allergic to these approaches because they are, in fact, leaping over the fact that we cannot know, and that the reason that we cannot know is because these people were murdered. So how do you represent that absence? Mm-hmm. I thought, well, the only thing that you can do is to draw as sharp a line as possible between what you can know and what does remain and what you cannot know, mm-hmm. and what has just been irretrievably lost. And by seeing that line, you can begin to intimate the magnitude of what is lost without trying to make up for it or to, you know, whatever, fill it in with numbers or fill it in with other people's accounts or with, you know, graphic horror details. So that was respecting that loss seems to me the same thing as respecting the individuality of these people. We cannot know who they are. Mm-hmm. There were a few survivors, and miraculously, as I said, I ended up meeting 7 survivors, including 2 who appear in my grandfather's film as children. And even to document their stories, people I met and spoke to, would have been impossible because there's simply too much. If you're going to respect the individual, that's a lifelong process. Probably even your best friends or your partners, you don't know everything about. Mm-hmm. They are mysteries to you in some way. How much more so people who are strangers to you, and how much more so than people whom you simply cannot reach. So I thought, yeah, respecting loss and respecting individuality were the same thing.
What process did you have to go through to make that film digital? Because in the documentary, you're talking about how it was curled up on the corners and that was a challenge to getting it now to what you could donate,
right,
and sort of add to the public record. When you first found it and discovered what it was, were you like, ah, let's get this quick somewhere that they can take care of this?
Yeah, absolutely. So in this research that I had done about the deterioration of old film, I knew at very least about what's called vinegar syndrome, mm-hmm. which is the sort of the off-gassing of certain chemicals in the original acetate that causes it to smell ultimately like vinegar, because it's acetic acid. And as soon as I opened the can that this film was in, I was sort of blown back by the smell of vinegar. So I knew that the film was in trouble immediately as soon as I picked it up. And what's more, in the course of its deterioration, you know, the chemicals had sort of melded into each other. So the film could not be unwound. It was mm-hmm. like a solid mass of plastic. So I was not able to view the original film the moment I found it. But fortunately, this film, along with the rest of the films that were in the box that I discovered, had been transferred to VHS videotape sometime in the early 1980s. So when I knew what was on it, I was able to watch that VHS, because we still had a video recorder, something that no longer exists. And so that was how I saw the content. And the moment I saw the content, I knew that the original had to be preserved. Mm-hmm. So I did some research about who had the best facilities for that and what would become of the film once it had been conserved, then ended up donating it to the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. And they donated it to the wizards at Color Lab, which is a restoration laboratory in Rockville, Maryland, where they spent 4 months giving the film the treatment, which allowed it ultimately to be very gingerly unwound. And of course, it was curled like a, you know, like a present ribbon that you've run your finger across. Mm-hmm. And it was impossible to transport it through a normal projector. But they have all sorts of gizmos which they create for each film to allow it to be transported. And they photographed each frame individually in super high resolution, and then we're able to print out those images onto new archival grade stock. So that is how the film has been preserved. The original, you know, is sort of damaged beyond repair by the process of conserving it, mm-hmm. of preserving the information that's on it. So that was how it became digitized. And then, of course, once it's digitized, you know, they put it up on their website. And, you know,
and this is ultimately how you found survivors that are pictured in the video.
Yeah. To go back to chance being sort of the other dominant theme of this, you know, I worked very, very hard. Of course, you want to find survivors. It's amazing to preserve film, and it's amazing to sort of look at the images, but you want to see if there's someone here out there who can help you understand it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I worked as hard as I could. And ultimately, it was chance that led the way, because it was up on the United States Memorial Museum's, Holocaust Memorial Museum's website. It was online, and 2.5 years after I found it and started searching for people, I got an email out of the blue from a woman in Detroit who had seen it online, and in one of those scenes where there's, you know, this gaggle of kids waving and trying to get their faces in the frame, she recognized her grandfather as a 13-year-old boy, and he's still alive. Mm-hmm. So he was the first survivor that I met, but it was kind of a twofer, because he had remained close with a boyhood friend of his who had also survived, who was also still living at that time in London. And so the day I found my first survivor, I also found my second survivor. And then subsequently, through a combination of research and chance and sort of following the one lead that leads to the next lead that leads to the next, I ended up connecting with the others whom I was able to interview.
In some ways, the film, the documentary, and also the book that you wrote about it sort of holds space for this unsettled absence that you, as you were speaking about so well earlier, intentionally left unsettled. How has the response been to these, this publication and also the documentary? Are people responding in a way where they want it to be more of a story with a nice bow at the end?
You know, I haven't heard that response, though. Of course, it's certainly possible. And I think leaving people with the longing to know more is more or less exactly what I hoped, because then you're feeling that absence, mm-hmm. and that's how you communicate it. You're tempted by getting into the lives of individuals to want to know about the other individuals, and you can't. And if that's the feeling that people come away with, oh, I want to know more and I can't, then I feel I've done my job, mm-hmm. in a sense. You know, I feel I've succeeded. And I think that's one aspect of the response to the book and to, of course, the documentary, mm-hmm. About it and the film. But, of course, film, the documentary, now reaches out into the world in a way that a book can only dream of. Mm-hmm. And so there are people all around the world seeing this film, the documentary now. And so, you know, I get responses from people all the time, you know, oh, my family was from there or from nearby. And, you know, and in fact, new connections have been forged as a result of that. So every time the story gets more publicity, new developments take place, and the documentary film, because it's been received so wonderfully and has played, you know, all around the world, and it's sort of the great emissary for the question, who are these people?
Mm-hmm. And in that way, also, the documentary continues to push out a little bit of space in the contemporary conversation to say this town mattered and these people mattered. Right. And what happened to them mattered.
And precisely because it was, as it were, an undistinguished town. It was mm-hmm. a town like many others, but it's remarkable because this film exists. And for that sense, it remains perfectly ordinary. Every other town was remarkable in its own way because of the people who lived there. And that, as I say, was my goal. You can't grasp the individuality of millions, mm-hmm. and you can grasp the individuality of a few, and thinking in those terms changes how you imagine the millions.
Mm-hmm. So for all of those listeners now that are following our conversation, one, obviously they can buy the book, and two, they can actually also watch the movie because it streams on
Hulu.
On Hulu, I think, and on Amazon. I'm not mistaken. Let me ask you, though, one more question, maybe just about the film itself, which I think comes out a little bit in the movie about the film. Mm-hmm. And that is, there is something about the technology. I mean, it's still brand new, right? It's really exciting. And so you feel that part of what you see is actually produced by the novelty of the camera itself, right? And it also, I think there's a point where you have a sense that the camera really wants to capture the buildings, but it's constantly obstructed by all these kids who are jumping up and down. So I think insofar as we kind of think about film as a document or evidence, there's also really clearly a sense that this is producing something. So how do you deal with that of sorts in terms of, you know, I'm just going back to the title of your book, or subtitle rather, Discovering a Lost World. It's the world that is it the discovery of a lost world, or is it more the world as it is produced by the camera, or how do you see that?
Yeah, I mean, I say, you know, this is an ordinary town, and, you know, in the promotional materials of the book, it's, you know, an ordinary day. Right. People see people just living their lives. But that's, of course, not true. Any small town, when strangers, especially under these circumstances, strangers from America arrive, you know, by car with a movie camera, it's a special day.
Right.
And so it changes the behavior of the town. It changes the behavior on the streets. It changes, you know, warps the space around them. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in some sense, we're the beneficiary of that change because people wouldn't have gathered in the marketplace the way they do in this film had the camera not been there. If he really walked through the town like an ordinary citizen who attracted no attention, we would have had a very different view of the town. We would have seen far fewer people because kids would have been in school and, you know, people would be at work. Whereas because of this, it became a holiday and everybody bolted from there. You know, the kids bolted from school to see. So, yeah, I mean, every medium changes what we think reality is. And in the early era of every medium, we think that, oh, it's a transparent medium and it's just a clean representation of reality. But of course, it changes it. And the excitement on the street is the evidence of how that takes place. I mean, I don't know how to deal with it other than to try to make that into a benefit for the research.
No, I think it may be either in the movie or in the book that I think the observation is made that in lots of ways the novelty of the camera scrambles actually differences.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right? Because you see actually young and old men and women, right, observant, non-observant. Everyone is there because for everyone the camera is exciting. So in that respect, it is also enabling maybe us to see something that, right, otherwise right? I mean, this is...
Yeah, of course.
You know, go along with your thought here.
Sure. I think, I mean, this is something that we say in the documentary film. It's sort of drawing from a recollection that the sort of central survivor in the story, Mr. Chandler, says, because there's this typography of hats, which represents the sort of social stratification of the society, right? There's the top of the stratum would be, you know, the yeshiva boys, right, who have a particular kind of hat, and then there's the children of the workers who have a different kind of hat, and ordinarily those groups wouldn't mix, right? Mr. Chandler, as a yeshiva boy, wouldn't be allowed to hang out with the children of some other families, despite how tiny the town was. But there they are all, you know, rubbing shoulders in the film. So the very fact of the camera being such a novelty, and of the Americans arriving being such a sort of creating such a holiday atmosphere, then all of a sudden, you know, the rules go out the window, and you see kids, you know, next to each other who ordinarily would have kept apart. So yeah, as a sociological effect, right, it changes the nature of the society that we're viewing, and now 85 years later, we think, oh, we're seeing an ordinary day, but in fact, it's not an ordinary day, right? You have to be conscientious as a historian in recognizing those differences. So I try and adumbrate that in both the book and in the documentary. On another level, as I say, we're the beneficiaries because we get to see all of these, you know, different strata of society, which where otherwise, you know, if we were just visiting the family, a particular family, we would see them and the people they associate with and not the rest of the community.
Let me maybe, you know, you're about to give the Burnett lecture, so we want to make sure that you have a little bit of a break and that you can eat and drink and all that. But let me ask, you know, one other final question maybe. You've been enjoying now a couple of years being invited talking about the book. And now we are, you know, presumably will enjoy many more invitations where you're invited to talk about the book that is about the original film and the film that is based on the book. So how's this as an author? Is this kind of got to be interesting because you don't know any longer possibly are the people responding on the book or on the film about the book? Or is this kind of a curious moment for you right now?
It is a curious moment. I mean, to sort of go from the serious to the ridiculous, I mean, film has such greater distribution than the book. So I just assume that if people know about it, they know about it because of the documentary film. And because the film got so much remarkable publicity that, you know, I had only dreamed that the book would be able to achieve. So, yeah, the film has just infinitely wider distribution. The book contains a great deal more information. You know, there's just more space and more, you know, nuance, I think, in speaking about the challenges of recovering or excavating this history and trying to construct or reconstruct a sense of what the town was like. The documentary film, however, I think has a, you know, it has a visceral impact, and it's the way that it was constructed, which is really the artistic inspiration of the director, Bianca Stichter, which is to stick with the original footage. There is no other visual material than these original 3 minutes of film, which she teaches then as a way of viewing the film, mm-hmm. which I think is really, really important, that we can linger and that there is more below the surface if we simply look longer, which was how I approached the book. As I said, I didn't want to write a Holocaust history. I didn't feel in a position to write a Holocaust history. I thought the only thing I'm in a position to do is look at this film and try and draw out what's in it. So if this 3 minutes is all I have as a starting point, what's in it? And if you ask that question, what are we looking at, persistently and seriously, it is an endless, bottomless question, right? You can satisfy yourself with, oh, we're looking at pre-war life, Jewish life in Poland. That's a perfectly reasonable answer, but it's a superficial answer. You can say, oh, we're looking at pre-war Jewish life in this particular town. Again, a good answer, a better answer, but really a superficial answer. Well, you start to look at the clothing, you start to look at the, you know, the dentistry, right? People's teeth, you see. You start to look at the arrangement of space in the town and the connections between people as they form groups on the streets. And you start to ask, of course, who are these people? How did they come to be on the street together? Why are they there? What were the, you know, is this person the mother of that person? Like, and suddenly you're in the depths of this community in a really profound and deep way. And I think that the film... So the film, in its approach, is congruent with that same approach, which was what I took in the book. Mm-hmm. So I don't find it to be too distinct, talking about one versus the other. I think that they both achieve the goal, as I said before, of making you want to know more, mm-hmm. and teaching you that if you look really closely, you can see the absences, and those absences produce longing, and that longing is the thing that helps us remember.
This podcast is hosted by a team of dedicated faculty and research assistants at the Ackerman Center for Holocaust Studies. You can learn more about our work and find upcoming events at our website, www.ackerman.utdallas.edu.